The answer to all of the stuff, the leaks, the everything else, is just give Ukraine what it needs to win. Period. End of story. It's worth every penny, and it's saving Ukrainian lives. So let's just get that calculation better and get it done.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. There has been a lot of news about Russia and the war in Ukraine in the last few weeks, from the recent revelation that intelligence documents have been leaked to the Wall Street Journal reporter who's being wrongfully detained in Russia. So with everything that's going on, we're going to talk to my good friend Molly McHugh about these developments and how they can shape the war. Molly is a writer and researcher, as most of you know, of Russian influence and information warfare. Her articles have appeared in Politico, Wired, The Washington Post, Lawfare, and other publications. And she's the lead author of a newsletter called GreatPower.us. She's also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University and one of the only people I've ever been to a war zone with. Hi, Woo! Molly.
Well, hello.
Welcome back. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah?
I guess.
We have a really great question from a listener named Keith. He writes, what is the difference between 2008 when Russia invaded Georgia and also the 2014 annexation of Crimea? Why didn't we support Ukraine and Georgia more then? What was different back then and what has changed now? Now, I will preface your answer just by saying, especially as it relates to Georgia, I think there's a lot that we need to remind people about that period, about that time. You have deep ties there. You worked there. And I think what happened in Georgia, I think, is really important to understanding where we are now and is often criminally left out of the conversation and narrative about Ukraine today. So is that all fair and true?
Absolutely. And thank you, Keith,
for the question. For a really, really excellent
which
question.
Which is exactly the right question all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, some of us teach whole courses about this question, basically. But, you know, it's exactly the right question. And I think...
Where do you begin?
Cynically looking back from the vantage point we now sit in, it's much easier to be a finger waggler. But, you know, nobody was willing to put Georgia in the same spectrum of things as Crimea until, like, 2016, almost. Like, it was just like... If you look at the timeline of...
So let's just be clear. What happened in Georgia?
August 2008, Russia invaded Georgia. Five-day war. Ceasefire negotiated. War ends. In the most simplistic form, earlier that spring, there had been a NATO summit, the vague pledge that Ukraine and Georgia will join NATO, period. As a statement made with absolutely no details attached to that. So in traditional form, there's a map membership action plan given to countries.
Yeah. George W. Bush basically signaled like, this is the route we're taking. This is the roadmap.
The Bush administration had been humongous advocates of NATO expansion, had gotten the Baltic states into NATO, had finished sort of these, you know, Eastern European post-Soviet closer waves of expansion into NATO, understood why this was important, really, really pushed the more reluctant Western European allies to get a lot of this work done in smart ways, and insisted, especially because Bush had a very unique view personally of Georgia and Ukraine because the Rose Revolution happened in 2003 on his watch, the Orange Revolution happened in 2004 on his watch. These were the two quote-unquote color revolutions that overthrew the lagging post-Soviet democratic quote-unquote structures in Georgia and Ukraine and brought in more Western-leaning, democracy-focused, reform-oriented governments that were of similar models, closely aligned at times. But, you know, Bush, there were... Georgia and Ukraine and a few other countries in the world that had these sort of democratic upsurges during his presidency, Bush felt very personally invested in them. Liberia, I think Nicaragua was one of them, but like, no, not Nicaragua. There was something Latin that he was really into too. But like, he had these countries where there had been these big changes when he was president that he felt very personally invested in. And Georgia and Ukraine were two of them. They both aspired then to be in NATO, both bordered NATO nations. Georgia on its Turkish border in the south. Obviously, Georgia's a little further away on the other side of the Black Sea. And then Ukraine on the other side of the Black Sea borders the Baltic states, Poland. But they expressed their desire to be in NATO. Bush really supported this. Many Western European allies were very reluctant, especially the French and Germans, on this. But Bush felt it very important to make this statement of, no, they're going to be in someday, because that was what he could get done then.
It was very much a someday.
It was without the someday, right. But the non-specificity made it a someday.
Right.
And so the statement was made by NATO in spring of 2008. And pretty much the next minute, Russia starts preparing for the invasion of Georgia, sort of understanding we have to change the possibility that this can actually happen in very visual terms. Mm-hmm. So all through the summer, and this is after, of course, so Putin comes to power 2000. There's this internal period of regaining control of all the shit that ran wild in the early 2000s and the Yeltsin years, or in the 90s and the Yeltsin years. Putin takes over in 2000. Those sort of first 4 or 5 years are about internal control, getting the oligarchs in line, mm-hmm. getting the services back in line, rebuilding structures of internal power, re-centralizing things away from federalization back to the center. Putin does all this stuff. And then sort of is ready for the next phase. And they start being more open. They start communicating more openly in public speeches about what's going to happen. In February 2007, Putin gives his famous Munich Security Council or Munich Security Conference speech, which is basically like, we're done being shat on by you, the West. It was a super hostile speech. Like, and everybody was sort of like, what just happened? But he gives this very hostile speech. Yeah. We're back. We're done being crapped on by you. We're going to assert our rights as a non-oppressed whatever. And it was sort of surprising to everyone who felt they had been helping Russia all of this time to reestablish itself in the post-Cold War period. And then in the spring of that year, you have... I may be getting the timeline wrong, but right after the speech, essentially, is the paired events in Estonia, the cyber attack on the Estonian government / system writ large, and the what became known as the Bronze Knight riots, the Bronze Soldier riots, which was sort of a kinetic pairing to the online attacks. Mm. But it was made to create chaos in Estonia in different ways. But this was kind of this
is all perpetrated by Russia.
Yeah, all this is Russian done. And it was made to send this signal of, we're not fucking around anymore. There's a different Russia you're going to have to deal with. Suck on it. And we didn't really get the symbol. Didn't really get the message, because everybody was still in like, oh, but we can make lots of money in Russia mode. And I think we get into 2008. There's more of this churn and sort of activity. Again, under the cover of there's a military exercise coming, Russia spends all this time after the summit, the statement of Russia or Georgia, Ukraine will join NATO statement.
Right.
They spend all this time and effort rebuilding rail lines to Georgia, moving troops toward Georgia, getting ready to invade Georgia, pretending it's a military exercise.
Yeah.
And then literally during the opening ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics in 2008, while all the world leaders are sitting in the stands with their little flags and whatever they were drinking or whatever, Russia begins the invasion of Georgia, which the Georgians knew were coming, which they had been warning was coming, which their Baltic allies had warned was coming, which the Ukrainians warned was coming, which the Poles warned were coming. Everybody was like, nah, the Russians aren't stupid. They're not going to do that. And there's literally, you can still find the footage of Bush sitting in the stands in the stadium in Beijing and some advisor like leaning over his shoulder, like, Putin just invaded. And he's like looking at what, you know, and it was, I mean, total missed warnings, total misinterpretation of Russian intent, total misinterpretation of what they would do.
On our part.
That everybody admits. And like, there's this fantastic General Michael Hayden, who was then the director of the CIA.
Also friend of Politicology.
Great dude, super smart guy. He tells this very now in a declassified sense anecdote of, you know, he's sitting in his office when this happens. And like Bush calls him on the phone from Beijing and is like, you know, Russia just invaded Georgia. Can we get a briefing on whatever fucking shit is happening? And Hayden's like, sure, sure. And like hangs up the phone and he like calls out to his front office and is like, do we have Georgia experts in the building? Can we get them up here? But the fact that we hadn't even like we were so not paying attention to this in the sense that nobody was even sure who was in charge of watching the things was like, oh, Jesus Christ. But it's a great story. But he tells the story very openly now. But we were not expecting this to happen. And again, it was in, if you read back through, one of the first things WikiLeaks helpfully dumped online was the like 700 page document dump of cables from the U.S. Embassy to the State Department, the U.S. Embassy in Tbilisi from the capital of Georgia back to the State Department during the war. And they're fascinating because you really get the perspective of this was not, I think now people sort of look back on it and they're like, oh, it was this little thing. It was just a little bit of fighting. It wasn't a real thing. This was a full war. Russia was bombing apartment buildings, you know, blowing up, targeting civilian infrastructure, things like hospitals and schools. What does that sound like? Bridges, you know, electricity infrastructure. They were doing things like starting forest fires. Georgia is a very diverse ecosystem in the different parts of the country. Iran was there, a beautiful, wonderful country. But there's many different regions. Part of it is very wooded. But the Russians were like starting forest fires, huge forest fires, just because why not? Like, why not create more chaos? And the Ukrainians and the Turks, who are obviously in the smoke fallout zone of forest fires of Georgia, were like, hey, can we just come in and put out the fires? Like, we've got the big planes that put out fires. You know, can we just come in and put out the fires? And the Russians were like, no, do that and we'll shoot down your fucking plane. So, like, they were totally trying to destroy in a serious way the infrastructure of Georgia. The goal was to topple the government of President Saakashvili, the leader of the Orange, one of the leaders of the Orange Revolution, or of the Rose Revolution in 2003, who had been sort of a, you know, democracy darling of the U.S.
He'd been sort of cleaning up corruption, and like he was elected on a wave of like cleaning up corruption, right?
Elected on the "we need to not be a failed state" platform, right. Had been lauded as cleaning up corruption. One of the things they famously did was, you know, fire the entire traffic police force in one day and rebuild it from scratch to start
get rid of
non-corrupt
the bribery.
Police.
Yeah.
It was really a success story. The Georgians who did this work did the same work in Ukraine after 2014.
Oh.
So like the skill sets of Georgians who have done this work, There are many Georgians in Ukraine working in the government, adjacent to the government. Having now been chased out of Georgia, which is a different story with its current oligarchic-led government. But this was a real serious attempt by Russia to topple the government of President Saakashvili.
To take back a former Soviet state.
To disrupt the Western course of the country, which, again, was not some issue of debate. Like, Georgians were wildly supportive of integration into Europe and into NATO, more so after the war, as typically happens. This was public sentiment that this is where Georgia belonged, that it is a European nation that belongs with its European brothers. And it remains a very public sentiment despite hiccups and getting off course in the last bit of time. But this was a real attempt to do that. Russia got within, I think it's 40 kilometers of the capital before their troops kind of had to go back and the ceasefire was negotiated. It was not great for them. I mean, this is, again, like a whole course that I teach, but they got way ahead of their supply lines. They were not ready to do this. It was a big wake-up call for them that their post-Soviet military reform had, in fact, been garbage. But that whole period then after, so there was a ceasefire negotiated, the war ends. Saakashvili does not fall, partially because the United States and other countries gave a tremendous amount of economic support to Georgia to keep the country from collapsing after the war, to keep the economic disruption from having a real impact on the country. And this was critical to allow it to continue on and not fall to chaos.
But we didn't arm the Georgians to fight back.
It's even stupider than that. So the Georgians, wanting to be in NATO, were trying to be good security contributors. They had the best Georgian troops were in Iraq when the war started because they were fighting with us. And so we had to sort of airlift them back. They get back on day three or whatever, you know, but it was not. I mean, the Georgians always had troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Because as NATO partners, because they really wanted to make the point, no, we're serious. Like, we want to help you. Ukrainians were the same. Like, we're in this. We're here. We're helping. We're taking the assignments nobody else wants. We're in Helmand Province in Afghanistan. You know, we're taking the hard assignments in Iraq. But it was this awkward period, August 2008, obviously. End of the Bush administration. Very strange election between Obama and McCain. McCain, a huge traditional supporter of new NATO countries, NATO aspirants, but also Georgia and Ukraine specifically, who was very outspoken about the war and the need to stand up against Russia. Obama on vacation in Hawaii when this happened, very slow response from the campaign. It really inflamed doubts about maybe he's not ready for national security. Briefly, very briefly, he dipped below McCain in the polls for the only time, essentially, in the entire election cycle. But then the economy collapsed, and that was the deciding factor, obviously. But so it had this strange, it had this strange thing here where the Bush administration, in a way you can understand, in a way we all regretted and was hoping that we were hoping they would be more aggressive and forward leaning. Traditionally, outgoing administrations don't stick the next administration with a major policy decision that they're going to have to deal with. And so the decision was, we're going to get this initial support package done, this $1 billion economic support package for Georgia, you know, helping mitigate the immediate impact of the war. Like, we're going to do this, but there's a lot of other things that need to be decided about Georgia that the next administration is going to have to take on. And because of this strange, sort of conception of this of the war and the Georgians, and because of the political nature of some of this during the campaign, the Obama people not really inclined to listen to the Georgian side of the story at all. They viewed this as a McCain project. Some of McCain's political advisors had been advisors to the Georgian government as well in the past. So there was this, like, really not, like, there was no love. There was no love there. And it took a while to overcome that. I worked with the Georgian government in this period. It took a lot of work to, like, rebuild the direct connections between the administrations in ways that were obviously important and critical because of this, like, bad news bears vibe. but also keep in mind, this was the headline policy of the Obama administration was the reset. So that meant you're prioritizing the relationship with Moscow over all of these other things. There's still tremendous fallout from this that is not addressed and we don't discuss. And certainly most of the Obama people do not discuss it in a reflective way.
From the failed reset policy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there were real costs to that, including we got to 2014 and Russia invaded Crimea. And so, Keith, your question, very apt, which is, why didn't we do anything? Like, why didn't we do anything after Georgia? The question was really, well, shit, what do we do? And I was not in the boat of shit, what do we do? It was obvious to me what we do, which should have been helping Georgia figure out how to defend itself, making clear to Russia that they are not the regional, you know, hegemon, that they don't have a sphere of interest where they get to fuck around with other people and their decisions to be democratic nations, their decisions of what alliances they want to join, all of these types of things. Instead, we were vague and sort of absent in this period, and it was not helpful. And, like, yes, the U.S. has always been in Georgia, supportive of Georgian reform, supportive of Georgian military training, all these other things. But in this period after the war, there's always U.S. Marines in Georgia that are part of a training facility because we were training Georgians to do things like deploy to Afghanistan and Iraq. But in that period after the war, we would only talk to them about that stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was like, we are training you for deployment. We will not discuss with you nor train you for national defense, which is crazy if you think about it. Like, we don't give a shit if you can defend your own borders, just if you can go to Afghanistan and war Iraq. And it got so dumb it's really bad. So dumb during some phase of this that, like, the Georgians, because we had sort of made it clear that everyone should be cautious. We fell into this trap of the narrative that the Russians were building after the war, which was the war was the Georgians' fault. They like were provoked into taking the bait and fighting this war as if the Russians weren't going to invade anyway with 120,000 troops sitting on the border. But like the narrative that the Russians advanced remains entrenched in how we talk about the Georgian War, that the Georgians fell into the trap, that it was their fault, that, you know, they were provoked stupidly, whatever. None of this is true. And I think in retrospect, you can understand how really dumb this analysis is. But because there was this belief in the reset period that we had to sort of support this idea of the war, there was a de facto arms ban on things to Georgia. So it was very difficult for them to acquire stuff. And it got so dumb, it was to the point where they couldn't get spare parts for their rifles to do things like deploy to Afghanistan. They would have to go to Afghanistan and then we would give them stuff there. It was completely silly. But this was the kind of, underneath the giant headline of the reset policy, there were 40 million tiny decisions like this made to appease Moscow, to please Moscow, to take an issue off the table with Moscow while we talked with them about green energy and tech cooperation and whatever other shit we thought was going to solve all our problems with Moscow. And for us, this is done and we're not talking about it anymore. But for every single ally we fucked over in that period by making these decisions that were Moscow-centric, they're not done with it.
Yeah, and like it's rightly
had,
so.
And it's had That's real costs for national security for some of these countries, for things like air defense, where we like pulled, you know, we were supposed to be doing these advanced artillery batteries in Romania and Poland. We decided not to do them during the reset. We have subsequently had to do them, but we're like behind in how we're doing all these things for the alliance. I mean, there were real costs to this policy that have not been fully evaluated, particularly in the aspect of how Russia built the trap of engagement that we believed in. And there are still people to this day, like Mike McFaul, for example, who believe Medvedev was a real, like, moderate option for Russia, and he was a smart guy, and if only we could empower then-President Medvedev, who was holding the chair while Putin had to fake support for the constitutional system of not being president at that moment. You know, there was this belief in the Obama administration that you could support a moderate choice in Russia and maybe that would empower him against Putin, as if he was not a Putin thing. And it was bananas. But they believed it and still believe it and still defend it. And like the amount of technology we transferred to Russia in that period is now being used against us. So this is all great. And like, again, I understand where it came from. I know but like, in the same way we as a nation are now able to be more critical of things like, wow, how did the Germans shut down their entire nuclear power industry and become dependent on Russia gas and this Nord Stream 2 thing? Like, that was a really dumb decision over 30 years, right?
Or the Iraq War, right? We have been very reflective about that, to say the least. And it seems to me there's
But especially on the Russian influence side, we're very able to look at other countries and say, wow, that was a really bad decision. But we haven't had that same come to Jesus with ourselves. And especially in the sense that these were not, you know, badly written Netflix series of Russian influence in the U.S. system where some guy was an evil, ideologically aligned pro-Russian guy. No, they were exploiting our goodwill and our nature of wanting to believe places want to be better, want democratic change, like, and understanding how that worked in our system and how it was exploited and how we weakened ourselves because of it is just super critical.
It is also just very, very Russian.
To
take the thing that we hold most dear, our values, and weaponize them against us.
So the thing with 2008 that's so fascinating is sometimes now we look at the military piece of it. There was this Russian invasion. We probably should have paid more attention. But we don't pay attention to the political warfare side, which is all the other things that Russia does
which
that
is
fuck with us.
What this was, yeah.
Yeah, and that, I think, is still a big weakness. So why did we decide not to do anything? Because it was hard to look at what just happened in Georgia, which was a country with a huge Ganges military crossing the border to crush the government of a neighboring country while slaughtering civilians and causing mayhem. Like, nobody wanted to have to deal with that. It was like, oh shit, like, what is that? Like, we haven't seen that in a while. Like, it's not in Europe. Like, we haven't seen that. And let's just leave it alone. It didn't happen. And so it was sort of excused as this incursion, as this little thing. The Georgians did it. Oh, if only they hadn't fallen for their whatever. And then everybody wanted it to be the anomaly and not the beginning of the arc. And so we engaged Russia. We figured, once again, someone looked at the binder and thought, oh, if only we explained to them, they should be in the West and it will all be better. And basically we gave them the space during that 6-year, 8-year period to revamp, rearm, sharpen their tools of political warfare, sharpen how their influence worked in our systems, sharpen their military reform, build these new weapons, do all these other things, build RT and Sputnik and all these things that now they're massive influence networks in the information domain, figure out how social media worked. We gave them this period of time to get it better.
Regroup.
And Crimea was the lesson they learned. And the invasion of Eastern Ukraine was the next phase of that.
So that this takes us, so that was 2008 mm-hmm. at the transition point, right? As Obama's coming into office. And now this takes us up to 2014 when Putin invades Crimea, takes the Crimean Peninsula, which I think I said this one of the first conversations that we had. People should actually, if you haven't yet, and if you really don't know the geography of Ukraine, you need to just pull Crimea up on a map and understand how strategically important it is.
Super important.
Because of the shipping lines and the port of Odessa, which is essentially the lifeblood of Ukraine's economy. And also, by the way, Africa's grain. Yeah, but that's a story for another time. Not at all unrelated, but this is 2014 now.
Yeah.
So presumably we have learned our lesson with Georgia. We understand now that we've been played by Putin.
But we didn't. I know, right?
So what happened then as Putin takes Crimea, again, invading a neighboring state under false pretenses, seizes the land, and we do what?
So there were lessons learned of Georgia applied, right? And one of the key lessons was, one, we have to get the information war right. They lost in Georgia during the war because there was a very capable team of Georgians and Estonians who were pushing back on the narrative that Russia was trying to sell, that the Georgians had started this war. And that made the space for the ceasefire. And I think we should just be very clear about that. Like, had the Russian information campaign, which was then very sloppy, won, there would have been a very different outcome to this. But much like in Crimea and everything after, like, the first deployment into Georgia was journalists, not soldiers. So I think we should just be very clear about who these people are. So, Sochi Olympics in 2014, in February 2014, this great pinnacle of Putin power that he had built. Sochi was this, I mean, and also not disconnected from Georgia. Sochi is on the Black Sea coast, Russia's Black Sea coast. So kind of between the Ukrainian Black Sea coast and the Georgian Black Sea coast. But a big piece of that Georgian Black Sea coast is Abkhazia, which is a region of Georgia occupied by Russia, declared as independent.
But, even today.
But the Sochi Olympics largely constructed out of Abkhazia. So they were like using the occupation as this strange tool of these Olympics, which was on purpose. But everybody hoped this was clearly important to Putin. They spent gazillions of dollars doing this totally misguided Winter Olympics in a subtropical climate in Sochi. They had to refrigerate the snow, like, totally stupid.
So Soviet.
It's also stupid. But everybody knew this was a big thing for Putin. There was this perceived opening in advance of the Olympics because he was hoping for good coverage and positive news and all the world leaders coming and praising him and his strange wonderland that he has built in Sochi. It's very important to him. He does a lot of official things there. One of the things that happened in this pre-Sochi period was finally the release of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who had been one of the first detained sort of dissidents slash oligarchs. He was finally let out and allowed to leave Russia. So there was this perceived opening in that time period. Russia built this narrative of well, you know, we're doing these Olympics right here next to the Caucasus, like the North Caucasus, where there's all these
terrorists.
There's all these terrorists. Like, yeah. did we mention there's jihadis all over the North Caucasus? So they built this cooperative environment of insurance of intelligence sharing in advance of Sochi, because you want to protect your athletes from terroristic threats coming here to Russia. And used all of this as cover for moving troops into position to seize Crimea right after the Olympics. So the November 2013 Maidan protests, also the end of the Saakashvili president in presidency in Georgia, when he left Georgia, I should note. But Maidan protests start in Ukraine. Then President Yanukovych had made the decision to not sign a trade and integration deal with Europe against what the people of the country wanted. So there's these huge pro-European protests that start.
Hugely popular, right?
I mean
the, so it was... They wanted to be integrated
with
Europe.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this was... And not signing that deal, which was this trade deal that would have opened the economy and would have been a tremendous benefit to the country, even if you hated Europe. Like, tremendous benefit to everyone in the country. Yanukovych stalled as long as he could, finally said, I'm not
a Russian guy. I mean,
was a Russian oligarch who was president of Ukraine. There's complicated stuff in Ukraine after the Orange Revolution, obviously, then had been returned to the presidency with the help of guys like Paul Manafort, I would note. We should never forget the role of American political consultants in some of this work. And but he decides finally, no, I'm not signing. We're not signing the deal. So in the same way that Medvedev, President Medvedev at the time in 2011, openly stated, we invaded Georgia because we needed to keep them out of NATO. And if we hadn't, Ukraine and Georgia would be in NATO now. The Ukraine invasion was about making the similar EU statement. Like, we get to decide who gets to be in Europe and not. And so Maidan protests start in November.
Russia. Right.
And so Maidan protests start in 2013. They continue through the whole winter, this very poetic burning square thing that many of us are familiar with now, of the Euromaidan protests.
Google. If you're not familiar with what this looks like, go Google Maidan protests.
And there are many good documentaries made, including Winter on Fire, a few others, that just, I mean, this was truly a citizens' uprising that had been from prepared movements for some time. I mean, people had been waiting for the moment to make this point for some time, but truly a sort of a case study of popular uprising that is worth looking at, whether you support or think it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
Really a beautiful thing. But that continues until February. Finally, there's this moment of truth where Yanukovych is deposed by the parliament. He's done stupid things in the interim. Finally deposed by the parliament, he flees the country literally like the next day. The quote-unquote green men, so these soldiers who were wearing uniforms with no insignias, pop up at all the critical sites in Crimea and sort of seize the peninsula within a week, basically, without...
And this is right after the
really
Sochi Olympics.
And it's right after... It's days after the Sochi Olympics concludes. And... So there was this, if you look back at it now, like now it's all like, oh, it's the green men. But at the time, the coverage of this was so strange. And I remember being, I think it was in Ireland at the time, doing some stuff. And the news coverage was like, who are these strange mercenaries?
Right. I remember
who
this.
We don't know yet.
We don't know who's doing this.
And everybody, like all of us were like, I mean, it's obviously, they're like, why are we pretending it's not the Russians? Everybody knew it was the Russians, but like, we don't know what's happening. So it was this dumb period of make-believe, but the make-believe really worked in Russia's advantage.
Yeah.
And since this was in this period where Yanukovych had been deposed or was being deposed, but still kind of in charge, like the order given was for the Ukrainian soldiers who were in Crimea to do nothing. And so Russia was able to seize.
So he gave that order.
Yes. The Russians were able to seize the peninsula with absolutely no resistance, despite the fact that in many cases, they actually weren't armed for it, and the Ukrainians who were there were armed. We're told to stand down and leave, and they did. And, I mean, again, lawfully following orders.
Right.
This was what they had to do. But I mean, again, having Yanukovych as this Russian tool in Ukraine is so critical to this whole thing. But the Russians rely on this so much. Like, no shots fired, no resistance. Clearly, the Crimeans wanted to be with us.
Right.
It's all nonsense, but they lean on the story a lot and don't think it hasn't informed the Ukrainian resistance strategy of we will fucking shoot you for every inch of territory in our country now because we are not playing this game of there was no resistance. It's been really sort of the underpinning to everything that has come after. But the Crimean thing, so literally within 2 weeks, Greenman, Russia's holding a fake, or, you know, Crimea has a referendum to declare itself independent, quote unquote, Crimea has a referendum to declare itself independent, and then applies to Russia to be annexed, and Russia annexes them, and on March 18th, Putin gives this big speech.
And this is all like sham orchestrated by the Kremlin, essentially.
Like, oh, I'm so sure you had an election within 2 days. Like, absolutely. That makes total sense. So all of this is, it's this very well-staged play.
Right.
But it worked extremely well, having learned the lessons of 2008.
Kind of well, which very is, well played.
Don't use your guys. Use guys with no labels, because then there's no accountability. It was an independent uprising, you know? Have the whole thing staged out. They had the whole thing done. And then, so they did this annexation, and literally everybody's standing around like, well, fuck.
Yeah.
What the fuck? Now what? And in order to ensure that there could be no reevaluation of the annexation of Crimea, which is incredibly strategic important for Russia in the Black Sea, in the Mediterranean, and everything they're doing now in Africa and beyond, they needed this for their strategic deployment concept. But in order to make sure this was not reevaluated in any respect, there was then the invasion of the territories in eastern Ukraine with this quote-unquote, it's local uprisings, you know, nonsense. Because then there was this hot war being fought. At the time, the Ukrainians called it an anti-terrorist operation for reasons that are important politically. But there was this other war to focus on that became the thing we had to negotiate about, the thing we had to talk about. So, Crimea was just like, we don't have time.
Yeah. We're not, it's not even. Yeah.
And it was, again, a very smart strategic move.
Yeah.
And this really then, obviously, it was Obama's guy leaning over your shoulder in the stadium moment of like, shit, the fucking Russians have fucked me too.
Yeah.
And the last years were more aggressive. There were some sanctions issued against Russia, blah, blah, blah. But did we do enough? No.
And so the reason, can I just go back to just to clarify
why we didn't do more?
For me and for our listeners, is how significant a reason that we didn't do more is the fact that Russia had built this narrative going into Sochi Olympics that, oh, we're kind of opening up. And they had essentially bought a lot of fake goodwill. They had manufactured a lot of goodwill for themselves. And so right after the Sochi Olympics, you think maybe they're turning a page, maybe they're opening up, maybe it's different now. And then Crimea happens. And so this sort of play that they had staged becomes borderline credible for a lot of people, maybe journalists too. And so this had a lot to do with like the political will, right? Not like, we're not really sure, if this is an anomaly now, or if actually we've just been played this entire time.
Yeah, I mean, erasing the two critical Georgian stories. One, the story of the war, which in 2014, no one was talking about.
Right.
No one was talking about the 2008 war. It was like, it never happened. And then in 2012, this Russian-y oligarch, I mean, he's a Georgian, but he made all his money in Russia, won the election
Stalin
against...
Stalin was a Georgian.
Stalin was also a Georgian, yes. I mean, this guy is now very openly pro-Russian. It's bad news. Anyway, in 2012, this oligarch dude won this election in Georgia against Saakashvili's party. So for the last year of his presidency, he was sort of cohabitating with this yucky faux pro-European party, which now is very openly not so pro-European. But so there had been this... There were these two sides of this. The fact that no one talked about the war because it was inconvenient to talk about it, so it was like it never happened. And then the story of the Saakashvili success, that there had been this pro-European, pro-Western popular uprising in Georgia that had taken control of the country, that had done all these things to fix the country, to reform the country, to give it a real economy. At the time of the Georgian War, I think it had something crazy like 8% growth. I mean, just like,
wow.
It was like a real country that was heading in the right direction. So undoing that story by having this Russian oligarch attack that story and saying, no, it was the bloody 9 years. You have no idea how bad these people really were. They're terrible human rights violators and blah, 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 blah. That was the other side, which is a whole separate course I can teach.
But the
political warfare side in Georgia is a whole separate thing. But so undoing these two stories of the war and of Georgian success was how we got to 2014.
Got it.
With no attention being paid to what was happening or what could happen or the potential of Russia to do this thing again. Yeah. Despite the fact that Putin had started telling people like Saakashvili, like the Moldovans, like others in like 2009 that Crimea was really important and he was going to take it back. And everybody's like, no, no, you're not. And he's like, no, I mean, I'm going to take it back. Like, they were very open about this. So I think this is again, this, it is very hard to deal with a large, economically weak, nuclear-armed adversary slash whatever we're calling it at the time, competitive nation, you know, whatever, near-peer competitor.
Profoundly cynical.
It's really hard to look at it when they do something bad and think, well, shit, what are the tools where we can actually do something useful here? When you don't want to do anything useful because it's hard and uncomfortable and disruptive. Yeah. But there was no will to do it. Until you get to Crimea, until you get to the invasion of Eastern Ukraine, where suddenly it was like, oh, fuck, like we've enabled this whole environment.
We were played.
And then still.
Do you think the sort of shame of that actually was part of the political calculation?
Nobody wants to admit that
we contributed to this environment.
Totally.
Nobody
wants to be the one who's like, I enabled this.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to admit this. We didn't know. Oh, it changed. Like, oh, it was Putin coming back into power. Like, yeah, whatever. No, it wasn't. And just this, again, the lack of direction about how we were going to deal with this. Like, in all this time, we weren't being smarter about how we were building defensive in NATO. Like, we weren't preparing our political toolkit in terms of influence and what we could do. We hadn't really been focused on sanctions or other sort of deterrent methods. But repeatedly from 2007, when Russia attacked Estonia and made it clear that like a different Russia was coming, until now, we have failed to understand what deterrence is and to actually deter Russia. And there's been this strange, clunky narrative since February 2022 in the reinvasion of Ukraine.
Which brings us to today. What's different now? Back to Keith's question,
yes,
which closes
and we'll
with...
get there. But there's been this strange, clunky narrative since then about, like, well, NATO deterrence worked because he didn't invade us, but we failed on Ukraine. Yeah. And, like, no, that's not deterrence. Like, if you fail to deter the behavior of the thing because it does not view you as a threat, there is no deterrence. And I think we can understand, in fact, we have no deterrent value against Russia in terms of its behavior and what it views as strategic decisions it's making on its own behalf. And we just need to revamp that whole calculus of how we're doing these things. We have many capable, smart allies that have been trying to help us in this regard, including now the Ukrainians, and we have been reluctant to embrace or learn those lessons. But we're putting ourselves in the position of having to do everything a stupider and harder and more expensive way that will likely be more costly to us in the future over and over again. And if we think that we're going to be able to do China when we haven't been able to do Russia.
Well, we should say that part of the reason, and you've done this so well, and I've referenced it so many times on the podcast, but part of that reason is political. And as you call it, this pincer of isolationist tendencies on both the far right and the far left. So part of the reason that we've been, that our response has been, let's say, lackluster so many times has a lot to do with domestic politics, which is part of the reason that we're having this conversation, that I think it's important for listeners to understand so that they can explain to their social circles just why all of this shit matters, because the political pressure is not a negligible piece of the calculation. And
And it costs lives.
And it costs lives.
After 2014, again, we were in sort of this, we'll sort of support Ukraine. Here's some economic relief. You know, here's some small training, here's some things. But the vast, and I am not downplaying the work that American trainers in Ukraine played in helping to train Ukrainian forces in that time period between 2014 and 2022. I'm not downplaying the role of any other NATO nation that was there helping Ukraine, participating in what they could. But all of this was like way back by Lviv, you know, like as far from the conflict as possible. And like, we just kind of need to own that there was this 6-year period where we could have done things that would have prevented 2022 from happening. But again, much like Georgia, we didn't do them for fear of, quote, provoking Russia. So we weren't arming the Ukrainians in a serious way. They kind of had to do all that work themselves. The war in eastern Ukraine, particularly in those first years, in 2014, 2015, 2016, grinding, lots of casualties, lots of Ukrainian casualties. Everything they had to do was harder and cost more lives because of not having the equipment they needed. And at the time, because Yanukovych had destroyed the army and left them with, you know, nothing. So they were starting from absolute scratch in 2014. But like, in all of this period, we could have been more serious about building a deterrent factor for Ukraine by integrating it into NATO, for example, or by helping it build real air defense, or by giving it the capability to really inflict damage on Russian forces that were targeting them. But we didn't. Like, we continually made the decision to make it just a little less bad for Ukraine and focus on things like anti-corruption and building the government and whatever else, as if any country can have any of these things without having security within its borders.
Yeah.
I mean, just it's fucking nonsense. But like, there were so many well-meaning Americans, Brits, French, Germans, whatever, within the system who were so focused on helping Ukrainian political reform while absolutely standing against arming Ukraine. Yeah. The same diplomats that would argue for budgets for anti-corruption work would be like, absolutely not. I'm not, you know, we should not arm Ukraine. Everything we're going to do here is going to provoke the Russians. Well, fuck that. Like, all you did was make a bigger target. And Russia was like, why not? And, you know, people are still like, this is so crazy. Why did Russia do it? And it's the answer is strategically, it's really valuable for them. And I just, there's still this miscalculation of how we're interpreting Russian will, Russian intent, and what they're getting out of it.
Yeah.
I'm not saying Putin is making totally rational calculations in this particular time period, but for him it is. And I think that's the thing that we need to understand. And we're still not adapting. Like, the number one thing we need to be focused on is deterrent capability. Or what the fuck is the point?
What is the point?
Like, do we really want to have to fight Russia
yeah.
in our own territory? Because I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Like, we know it's going to be fucking horrible and bad. Like, we know what it looks like now. Yeah. Let's not do it in our territory. Let's fucking kill those motherfuckers in Ukraine so we can stop doing this.
Yeah.
And we're still not focused on that. And the Ukrainians are paying the price every day.
So to land the plane, what has changed now is, I think something we've spent a lot of time on, but to encapsulate it, do you think we have thoroughly learned our lesson, or is there something else going on here that's driving interest?
I think there is now more discomfort with living inside the delusion of engagement with Russia than there previously was. And the piece I was mentioning in Politico that was this weekend that is worth understanding in this context is...
Also, I think it's probably, we shouldn't discount the fact that through this trajectory, we've started with 2008, now we're up to today, what's different now? One thing that is wildly different than in 2008 and in 2014 is the immediacy of the news cycle and and the ubiquity of information. So
at the beginning of February 2022, the extremely powerful online information machine that the Ukrainians were able to enact, which may not even work that way now because thank you Elon Musk, but which is interesting in so many ways.
Yeah.
But so for example, after 2014, we had all these sanctions against against Russians and Russian oligarchs and Russian businesses, whatever, in various phases and waves. in response to different waves of aggression against Ukraine and other things. But basically, they weren't enforced. And that was what this piece in Politico was about. It was like, what's different between 2014 and 2022 is like, now we're actually enforcing things a little bit. And oh, that's bad for their economy. And the fact that we never bothered to do it before because there just wasn't priority put, it is hard. It is extremely hard to go after these things when it's like, you know, layers and layers of shell companies and showing who is owners. But like, it's the best, it's one of the best tools we have that people are actually willing to use, which is these now commonly agreed sanctions and sort of the unity behind the sanctions and the willingness to do the work to enforce them is a big difference on the sanction side. But I think really the big difference is after 2008, after 2014, everybody just sort of put their, but it's so hard. And like, I'm getting things from Russia coat back on and hoped that they weren't going to have to do anything else. And, you know, the Germans kept building Nord Stream 2 and everybody kept negotiating deals and like we kind of didn't do that much and they were still coming here to visit and talk to us and like.
Yeah, but then 2016 happened here. We had Russian interference in our own elections. We have had aggression on our own soil.
There is the understanding that what Russia does isn't just about its neighbors, but about all the rest of us too. And this whole period has
which
helped.
Is new since then.
And I think most critically, as part of what you mentioned, has made how we talk about Russia in many Western societies a public, domestic, political topic. And sometimes that is very hazardous and bad. In the U.S., it has created this strange polarization about Russia that doesn't need to exist.
Because everything is positional.
Everything is positional now. But there is more public discussion about Russian political warfare and what that means and what it's done to Ukraine than there ever would have been before. So it made it near impossible for many places to ignore what was happening, but also just the scale of what Russia attempted to do. And frankly, the noise we made in advance, like here we are 6 months in advance, like Russia's going to invade Ukraine. Yeah. They're going to blow the shit up. Place.
Yeah. I remember that conversation. Yeah. So they've been lined up. They're lined up like waiting. Yeah.
So disheartening. But, we made all this noise about this thing and then we had to do something about the thing because it happened and the Russians didn't win. And then it was like, fuck, like now we have to do something about this. So now we're in this fuck, what do we do about it place? And we still haven't owned a strategic goal. And that's the problem. And like, yes, I, as a non-military commander with no military experience, can obviously say this, but if you don't believe me, you can look at other former commanders of U.S. Army Europe and other former SACers and other things. And like General Ben Hodges, Mark Hertling, others who talk about the same thing, that our lack of specified, spoken, what is our strategic goal and our support for Ukraine is hindering everything.
Yeah.
And we need to be clear.
What are we afraid of? Why hasn't
about
that
what
happened?
That thing is?
Why hasn't the administration been explicit about our goal?
It's such a deep question. I do think there are some people.
I do also have a separate sort of. Congress is appropriating these funds and we're sort of fighting this proxy war with Russia and Ukraine.
It's not a proxy war.
Okay. Okay.
Don't call it that.
Okay. We have absolutely circumvented the intended check and or balance of Congress declaring, you know,
but bipartisan support, which is really
bipartisan support.
Really
I agree. Yeah. Like, but both sides have essentially abdicated this role of Congress
because
to declare when
matter.
The U.S. is going to entangle itself in other, right? But anyway,
this is a broader conversation.
That's a broader
about
conversation.
Congressional powers that I agree needs to be had, but maybe not with the current Congress.
Correct.
Which is like,
correct. But anyway, since we're doing it this way and we're just appropriating money and the administration is in charge, why hasn't the
and we have
been
these vague things, even more vague now than we used to say. The phrase that they seem to be locked on right now is until the end.
Yeah.
We will stand with Ukraine, not support Ukraine, unarm Ukraine. We will
stand with Ukraine
until the end. The end of what?
The end of what?
What the fuck are you talking about? And like,
what does success look like? What does victory look like?
Well, but they won't use the word victory anymore, which is interesting. And it's bad. And I mean, look, some of the people making these decisions are not people I would want to be making these decisions on Russia, having seen how they do this in the past. And I don't think there's been this learning curve of the 2008-2014 stuff, as we have discussed briefly here.
I know I know a podcast they can listen to.
and I think there's this... I think there are some people, and I'm not even necessarily sure who believe in this sort of self-made narrative of, oh, it's good for us that Russia is bogged down in Ukraine and the Ukrainians are slowly chewing them into bits and blah, 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 blah. Like, this is great. It's like, it's not great. It's great for China that, like, NATO resources are sunk into this and Russia's busy and destroying itself. But for anybody else, like, but this idea that, like, somehow this is worse for Russia than the rest of us is not smart. And also, again, can we talk about the dead Ukrainians and what we're asking them to do every day without the right stuff? They still don't have individual weapons and body armor. Like, it's fucking insane. And, like, it is amazing that Ukrainians can crowdfund drones and drop grenades from, like, little pieces of toy shit that they've brought in from Poland and blow up Russians.
Or that Politicology supporters can help crowdfund winter coats for the soldiers that you literally hand-delivered to them, but that also shouldn't have had to be done in the first place.
Like, I'm glad to do it. I'll do whatever I can. Everybody else who's in the... Yeah. I mean, all of the Balts who are driving constant streams of trucks to Ukrainian soldiers feel the same. Like, we'll do it if we have to. But why the fuck do we have to do this?
Right.
I mean, it's madness that we've we've created this dynamic of a crowdsourced war where it's kind of great because now so many people feel directly invested in which politically in all of our countries has this enormous impact, which is not small. And I think that that's important, but like, madness. Like, what state wants to abdicate the ability to wage war to fucking people on Twitter? No offense to all of us on Twitter, but like, it's madness. Like, so it's very frustrating that the lack of strategic goals has left all these gaps. The Ukrainians are filling them how they can. They're not unaware of what we are asking of them. It's just that they understand they would have to do it anyway. Like, even if we weren't giving them anything, they would get the sticks and rocks and kill the Russians with their hands if they had to. But they're not unaware that the way we're asking them to do it is the hardest way, with the most casualties, with the most damage to the largest area of their country. And if you spend any time on any social media, you see the parts of Ukraine, like Bakhmut, like other cities, that now look like Idlib, that now look like Grozny did. This is how the Russians fight wars. They fucking kill everybody and blow everything up and sort the rest out later. And I think there's been, there was a good report written recently. I can send the link if you want to link it, but about the political warfare aspects of what's been happening in Ukraine during this newest phase of the fighting. And what it has made public, which is something we've all been discussing, but it's not really a public thing. So now that it's in public, it's good. Is like, yes, the war is like, the Russian war effort is as inept as has been discussed. Like, this is not a sophisticated modern army with slick targeting and decentralization. It is clunky and not great. But the administration of the occupation is quite sharp. And the cost to civilian populations, because the Russian intelligence services run the occupation, not the army. So the cost to civilian populations of being in occupied zones, the damage to the economy, the damage to society, the damage to individuals and people, the number of people who have been summarily executed, tortured, deported into Russia, the thousands and thousands and thousands of children who have been stolen from their parents and sent into Russia. All of this is...
To who knows where in Russia, right? I mean, they just...
It's all fucking crazy. Yeah. The whole thing is fucking crazy. And for this, Putin has finally been indicted by the International Criminal Court, because it's kind of the lowest hanging fruit. Like, stealing children and forcibly adopting them into Russian families is obviously
you can't spin your way out of that.
It's... So, I mean, I think there'll be more, but this is a good first indictment of Putin. But... all of these things are horrible and monstrous, and the administration of the occupation is as Soviet and terrible as you can imagine. And the cost to people is devastating. And whether you get out alive, as a recent report of some girls who were taken to one of these re-education camps and managed to sort of escape with the help of some journalists.
Oh my God.
And they were like, initially willing participants, because they dupe you into believing, oh, we're just going to the camp, you know, and they're like teenagers who want some normalcy. I don't know.
To talk to the journalists then.
The report was done by OCCRP, which is mostly like an anti-corruption thing, but some of their people helped, because these girls managed to keep their phones. They were still occasionally posting things on social media, right? So these journalists sort of found them and figured out a way to help them get back to Ukraine. But just listening to the way they talk about it as teenage girls who just want like a chance to go to the beach when everything is shit, and them slowly coming to the realization of how they've been manipulated and used and how awful everything is and like the cost of all of this to their country, like on every level, there is not a single Ukrainian family that has not been disrupted, affected, made to pay directly for this conflict. And I honestly don't know how people can sleep at night continuing to make decisions where that calculus is okay. Yeah. Like, yes, they are fighting for the future of their own country, and they are going to do that and are happy to do it, are willing to do it. There is absolutely no change in the political will of Ukrainians in this whole last year plus of what has happened. No weakening of resolve. Nothing has changed for them. But why are we making them do it the worst, most costly way for their nation when we understand Putin's goal is to erode the Ukrainian nation? And now the Ukrainian nation is split and divided and being mindfucked into becoming Russian children and being like absolutely fucking carpet bombed into oblivion. And we're just like, oh, that makes sense. Like, no, it doesn't make any, we're giving what he wants. And I just think we need to be clear about
what is our
that we need to win, that Ukraine needs to win, that it needs to take its full territory back under its own control to make decisions about its future. And that may not look like what we think it looks like. And we need to give them the capability to make those strategic decisions of how the actual fighting happens on their own. And stop fucking it up. Like, here we are 14 months into this most recent phase of the thing, and we still aren't making enough munitions. Like, we knew, we had to know, like, I'm not a war planner. And my question in March last year was, have we told them to make more of the things? And the answer was, oh, I don't know. Let me check. And we haven't. And like, we're just starting to do it. And like, the Estonians are doing some good stuff to build up the European production side. Like, there's these new joint initiatives to try to make and procure munitions. But why are we so slow? And why didn't we decide to do this sooner? And why do we make it cost so fucking bloody much?
Maybe one part of that answer has to do with the fact that DOD can't pass an audit. But anyway.
But it's not about that.
But
not being able to pass an audit should give them more flexibility dispersing funds as they see fit.
She just said, well, we can't pull up an inventory and tell you where things are.
I know.
So that's not great, Bob.
And there was a former soldier who's now a journalist. I can't remember who it was, but put up exactly the right analogy of that very terrible John Stewart interview
with the Deputy Secretary of Defense.
But it was really sort of painful. Like, don't go on John Stewart. No. Don't talk to John Stewart if you don't know what you're going to say. The soldier analogy was, if you're on base, like if you're assigned to a base, and like one thing goes missing, a grenade, you know, because sometimes people try to steal stuff as like trophies, like a gun. Like, if one thing is discovered missing from the base inventory, there's like a lockdown. They overturn everybody's, like, until they find that thing, it's like a major investigation. But somehow, like, DOD doesn't have a master inventory sheet of like, where are our tanks? I don't know. Did we leave them in Texas? Like, it could be anywhere. Like, what are you talking about right now? Like, if Amazon can tell me exactly where my tube of lip balm is, you should be able to tell me where a warship is. Like, what on earth are we talking about? So anyway, there are internal flaws that we need to overcome.
You know how, like, when you're going through your closet, you put on a jacket and you, like, accidentally find $100 in it? Like, where did this come from? Whoa!
How did I not know? Yeah, exactly. I wish I was finding $100 bills in my pockets these days.
Maybe the Pentagon's having similar... Anyway.
Hey, look! Well, to some extent, yes. It's like, hey, here's the shit we haven't used in 30... Maybe the Ukrainian... And they're like, yes, we will take it. Just send it in the mothballs. We'll figure it out. Yeah. But the halfwayness of everything sucks for all of us.
Yeah.
It's bad for us. It's costing us more. It will take longer. It will take more things. It's bad for Ukrainians who are paying in blood and nation and identity and everything else. We're leaving these strategic questions open in a way that, as much as we love to talk about our unfounded, never been so unified.
Yeah.
It is actually having corrosive effects within the alliance.
So would one thing people could do, because I'd like to see some political pressure on this point,
yeah,
be to call your representatives, call the White House and say, what is our strategic objective in Ukraine? What is our strategic goal? I support the effort. I support like Ukraine. And also, can you please articulate what our goal is and why?
Yes. As much as I hate that it is still this way, kind of, the whole like calling / writing Congress folk is a real thing.
It is
and
a real
they have
thing.
To answer you and account for your emails and calls
it
and
is
whatever.
A real thing.
So as much as I also mostly resort to Twitter rage, pointing those things in the right direction is important. And I think, again, there is a lot more bipartisan support for what we are doing in Ukraine than is broadly discussed, because many Republicans are hiding and trying not to draw fire from the crazy lunatic wing.
But the crazy lunatic wing, to be clear, one of the things, it is small, but one of the things that they will say is, we don't even know what we're doing there.
Yeah.
And that is
which
to
is
your point.
Which is not incorrect.
Which is not incorrect. Which is, well, we haven't articulated it. And so one of the ways to take that quiver of arrows away is to articulate it.
And stop undermining our own message where it's like, stand with Ukraine until the end. Oh, but also then we'll say, we've made the determination they don't need X for this phase of the fighting. No. Either they're the ones fighting the war and we just need to listen to their assessment of what they need so they can execute the war, or we're the ones fighting with them and with some skin in the game. And then we can say things like, no, you don't need this right now. But we can't have it both ways, which was what we've been trying to do. Yeah, and I know there's this, again, it's driven by this cautious line of, we don't want to quote unquote provoke the Russians.
Right.
And the Russians have done a good job of playing up the nuclear threats and the Putin's not going to nuke anybody. But like this, we fall into this don't provoke Russia. It's like, what would we provoke? What are we fucking talking about right now? Like, how is it going to get any worse than this? And the answer is, for Ukraine, it can't. So we just need to stop living inside our self-excuse bubble and do what we know needs to be done, which is hard and it requires real leadership. But the Biden administration doesn't get to sit here with its banners about the democracy summits if it's not going to do what is necessary in Ukraine. And it's just that simple. And it's hard, like...
Yeah.
You know, it's hard. I'm not, again, more has been done than I feared we would not do. But, and I'm so grateful for all of that, because it really could have been much worse had the Ukrainians not dragged us forward kicking and screaming into this. And I think that's sort of, in all these years of doing stuff in these places, you know, the message that I always sort of use is like, there's nobody coming, there's only us, right?
Yeah.
And, but that's the thing everywhere I've sort of come to realize is like, in all the places where we've engaged, in all the places where we've quote unquote promoted democracy, actually we didn't do anything except show up after the other people had done really hard work and joined the parade. Like, hey, Georgia, you overthrew your, you know, not great government. Like, woo, Ukraine, you know. Like, there is no democracy promotion. There is democracy aspiration from other countries that we sometimes show up to support and sometimes not. And like, it's so fucking disheartening when you look at it that way, but it is absolutely the truth. And in this case, we need to follow through. If we do not get this right, it's the end of all the pretend, and in every aspect of the pretend.
Yeah, it is not just Ukrainian territorial sovereignty that is on the table here. It's much bigger than that.
It's the future of our alliance.
Yeah.
It's the future of every other alliance.
Western order.
It's the rules, it's all the other things, and you'll hear people kind of say this in semi-articulate ways without backing it with action, other than the Balts and the Poles and the Finns and Swedes and a few others. And we just need to get this one done. Like, there's no alternative to getting it right. If we get it wrong, like... we're not going to have another 6 years and then another thing. It's going to be a lot worse. So, yeah. Sorry for the very long answer, Keith. If you want to talk about it more, I've got years worth of material.
You got more than you bargained for. Also, there's a course available at Georgetown.
I don't know. Maybe I'll do a podcast version. Who there you knows? Go.
But other people can pay you by signing up at your newsletter. Yes, greatpower.us.
Greatpower.us. But yes, and Ukraine just, the answer to all of the stuff, the leaks, the everything else, is just give Ukraine what it needs to win, period. End of story. And that should be a political force in this country for people running
give
for office.
Give them what they need.
We expect give you to support this. And it's that easy. It's not really that, it doesn't really cost us that much for everybody who's trying to wave their arms about it. It's worth every penny. And it's saving Ukrainian lives. So let's just get that calculation better and get it done.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. And make sure you're subscribed so you get notified when the second part of this conversation drops next week. If you haven't yet, we'd appreciate it if you could open up the Apple Podcasts app and give us a 5-star rating and review over there. This helps us rise in the rankings so that new people can discover Politicology organically. If you have questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. And even when we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.